There's now quite a shift of pace as we turn to Book 5, which focuses on politics and government, and we're going to start with Chapter 1, Part 1 on the expense of defense. The formal title of Chapter 1 is Of the Expenses of the Sovereign or Commonwealth, and Part 1 of that is called Of the Expense of Defense. Note that this chapter will be broken up into several different parts, and each will get its own video. It's noticeable when you enter Book 5 just how much Wealth of Nations is now becoming a book on the polis and a book on politics, and not just a book about economics. You can read Wealth of Nations as in part having the theme that economics matters for politics too. In Book 5, Smith is addressing a lot of the classic issues of ancient philosophy, including Greek philosophy, but through the lens of 18th century Smithian economics. Smith had already noted that defense was more important than opulence, and the very first sentence of Chapter 5 is important, and I quote, "The first duty of the sovereign, that of protecting the society from the violence and invasion of other independent societies, can be performed only by means of a military force." Smith then moves to a comparison of two different modes of warfare depending on what an economy is based. So Smith starts by talking about a society of hunters. Hunters are pretty much always ready for war, and they're always fit, and they have a kind of martial spirit. Nonetheless, even a large hunter army is going to be very small, probably no more than a few hundred men. Shepherds, in contrast, are less fierce than our hunters, but they have a fixed place of settlement, and they have a stock of subsistence, and in fact it's possible to raise a much larger army of shepherds, perhaps several thousand. So ultimately, a force of shepherds will be stronger than a force of hunters. Smith is suggesting here that prosperity is mattering more than martial virtue. But even with shepherds, much less hunters, an army for defense doesn't cost that much, but it's also not going to be very large. Smith now turns his attention to what to him was the modern world, and he argues why government revenue for defense is needed. And there are two primary reasons. One is progress in manufactures, and the other is improvements in the art of war. One simple way to put this is that if you have firearms, well, it costs money to buy or make those. Smith writes, and I quote, "It is the wisdom of the state only which can render the trade of a soldier a particular trade separate and distinct from all others." And with this remark, Smith is returning us to one of his key themes of division of labor. And ultimately, warfare for Smith comes down to having a wealthy society which can afford division of labor and having politicians who are smart enough to promote division of labor when it comes to the armed forces. And again, this is in place of martial virtue, and you can think of this as a vision of national defense, very different from what you find in ancient philosophy or even a lot of British writings of the 17th century. Smith goes even further, and he suggests that a well-regulated standing army is superior to a militia for purposes of defense. Keep in mind that a great deal of 17th century Republic and Commonwealth British philosophy stressed the idea of having a people's militia as fundamental to a free society, and drew a picture of a standing army as fundamentally dangerous to liberty, but Smith is very much arguing against this point of view. For further historical background, keep in mind there was a 1757 Militia Act which created a professional national military reserve for England and Wales, but not for Scotland. The fear was that a Scottish militia would ultimately create political trouble. Now, Smith, in fact, did not favor excluding Scotland from having a militia, but when he published Wealth of Nations and basically poo-pooed the idea of a militia somewhat, this actually got him in trouble with a lot of people in Scotland. The Scots had been angling for a while to have their own militia, and all of a sudden Smith was saying, this isn't so great or isn't so important. This was highly controversial. So how was it that Smith argued that a standing army is favorable to liberty? Essentially, he claims that a standing army makes a sovereign feel more secure, and he contrasts this to earlier times when, for instance, you do not generally have standing armies, and then any jealousy or any rumor or any potential sign of trouble really threatens the entire existence of the sovereign, and the sovereign then has to overreact by crushing dissident elements within the population, And Smith thought that having this more secure sovereign backed by a standing army would, in the longer run, give the citizenry more liberty. So again, we have Smith reiterating some key themes. Well, how is it that modern defense differs from the defense of the ancients? Modern defense depends on wealth, and it also depends on a willingness to exploit the division of labor to make armed forces more effective. Here's a good and representative passage from Smith, right near the very end of the chapter, and I quote, "In modern war, the great expense of firearms gives an evident advantage to an opulent and civilized over a poor and barbarous nation." For some very useful historical background on this chapter, I recommend a good piece by Richard Scher. It's called Adam Ferguson, Adam Smith, and the Problem of National Defense. By the way, Ferguson on defense was a major influence on Smith, and Smith is in some regards responding to Ferguson, and Scher explains this very well in his piece.